anti-migration sentiments were highest in places of Central and Eastern Europe. The problem is that there were no migrants there. And part of it comes from that it is very much the trauma of the people that have left, not simply the fear of the people that are going to come. When you're asking all East Europeans, what is the best thing that happened to you after 1989, they're going to say opening of the borders. People can study, they can travel, they have a simply a much more interesting life. When you ask people what worries you most, the answer is opening of the borders. So the best and the worst is the same thing. Living in countries like Bulgaria or Serbia or Croatia, because this type of a demographic problem is everywhere. Croatian census was just published several weeks ago. For the last 10 years, Croatia lost 9% of its population. When this is happening, the very fact that others are living and you are staying kind of forces you to feel as a loser even if your life is okay. Because your friends are not around. In a certain way, there is nobody to share your success with. The most interesting about the Balkans is not being asking what will happen in the Balkans. The question is, what of the things that is happening in the Balkans today are going to happen in other places?
Hallo liebe Aha-Hörerinnen und Hörer. Es ist Samstag und es gibt wieder eine neue Episode in diesem Podcast-Feed. Ivan Krastev beantwortet die Frage, wie stabil ist der Balkan? Ivan Krastev ist bulgarischer Politologe und er hat schon vorher ein Buch über dieses Thema geschrieben. Und zwar heißt es Das Licht, das erlosch. Darin geht es um Osteuropa nach dem Mauerfall. Christoph und ich sind wirklich große Fans von diesem Buch, darum hier eine Buchempfehlung, Das Licht, das erlosch. Wir packen es euch in die Shownotes. Jetzt aber wünschen wir euch viel Spaß mit der Audioversion dieser Lecture.
Thank you very much and thank you for coming. Seeing people is such a rare thing these days. And secondly, when I got this invitation with the title House Table at the Balkans, I didn't have an idea what people wanted me to talk about. Because on one level, you can answer this question with just two sentences or two words. The Balkans are dangerously stable. As my colleague, Albanian political analyst Ramzi Lani said, we had a transition from repressive to depressive regimes. My idea when it was coming was not to try to tell you who is governing how badly in all of our countries, but to try to think about the Balkans of the last 30 years as a kind of a political laboratory and what we have learned and not learned as a result of it and how it helps us to understand what is going in places which are not Balkan. And I'm saying this because being a Bulgarian, it is a very strange perspective talking about East, West and where the Balkans are. My first trip to the West was a trip to the Balkans. So in 1990, in March, it was just after the end of the communist regime in Bulgaria. By train, I had been going from Sofia to Dubrovnik, where there was a famous series of seminars every spring and summer. And I should tell you that never in my life I was so much impressed, like when you basically cross in 1990 the border between Bulgaria and the former Yugoslavia. This was like going from a black and white movie to a color movie. Because, listen, of course, Paris is quite more impressive than Belgrade. And London is more impressive than Zagreb. The problem is that if you're Bulgarian, you don't compare with Paris and London. And also what is quite important is that back then for us, and we have not been traveling much, Bulgaria was quite a close country from this point of view. You go, this was before the Yugoslavia started collapsing. In 1990s, political analysts were claiming that Yugoslavia, better of all countries in the Eastern Bloc, have been prepared to join the European Union. There was a talks about this. And this was perceived even as a way to keep the country together. And then in the period of 10 years, everything went totally different. You have a war. You have basically hundreds of thousands of people dying. And then the Balkanization and the Balkans became the very opposite to what Europe is. When you basically try to say that something is going wrong in Europe, you're saying you're seeing a Balkanization. And then I was trying to imagine, okay, and then everything that was happening in the Balkans, strong ethnic nationalism, basically huge competition between different ethnic communities, the major interpretation was this comes from the past. So when Europeans were talking about the Balkans in the 1990s, they were talking about Europe that has disappeared everywhere else and basically has survived only in this corner. But then now, with everything that we see everywhere, the rise of kind of a populist, illiberal governments in parts of Eastern Europe, the kind of a threat of a war in the post-Soviet space, my question is the following. Imagine for the moment two political scientists. In 1990, one was asked to go to Belgrade and to follow only former Yugoslavia without having an idea what is happening in other places. The only thing that he can know this is going to be his laboratory is only what is happening in the former Yugoslavia. And the other being asked to go to Prague or to Warsaw or Budapest and also not to have an idea what is happening on other places. Whom it is going to be easy to understand certain of the things that we are seeing in Europe today? The one who stayed in Belgrade and was seeing the rise of ethnic nationalism, how quickly, for example, the economic interdependence can become a kind of, can be weaponized, how easily people that have been living together can turn against each other, or those who in 1990s, basically in Eastern Europe, believed that the end of the history has arrived, that the nationalism has disappeared, and basically what we expect is that in a period of two or three decades, there's not going to be a major difference between East and West. I'm saying this because, in my view, strangely enough, the Yugoslav experience was very much under-conceptualized. We believe that everything that was happening in the Balkans was very Balkan. The idea was you can explain it because of a very specific history of the place, which is true, like every history is very specific, because of a combination of the factors that cannot be found anywhere else. Now, with the passing of time, at least my reading is that many of the things that we're seeing as specifics turned out to be much more universal. And having this perspective, I'll try to look at what is happening in the Balkans today and just give you one type of a trend which I see in the region and which I do believe is going to be important for many places far away from the Balkans. And in order to give you the perspective what I'm going to talk about, let's start first telling you a novel, Bulgarian novel that was published just several months ago. So this novel is written by a very well-known Bulgarian author called Alek Popov. It's called Mission Turan. And it starts with an old man who died in a remote village somewhere in Bulgaria. And he was the last person in the village, so the village dies with him. And this was not going to be a news to anybody because for the last 30 years, every month a village is dying in Bulgaria. If it was not for the fact that with the death of this person, the Bulgarian population went under 7 million. In 1990, it was 9 million. By the way, the truth is that at the moment, Bulgarian population is 6.5. So the author, when he was writing his satirical novel, quite overestimated the numbers we're talking about. So because of the death of this person and because of the fact that the population went under 7 million, there was a moral panic in the country. Suddenly, the talk was, we're dying. When the last Bulgarian is going to be around? So, in a certain way, the whole population started basically to view itself like the famous The Last of the Mohicans, Cooper's film, And this became such a huge problem that the president of the country realized that if something is not going to be done, he's not going to be reelected. But what to do? Of course, he can open the country for migrants, but this is the only thing that he cannot do. Because he was elected during the refugee crisis in 2015, 2016, promising that he will not allow a single non-Bulgarian to come to the country. But what to do with the Bulgarians? The problem is that around 1.5 million people has left the country, but they didn't show any interest to come back. They were coming back only after dying. Even now, and this is a fact, around 90% of the people who are living abroad still wants to be buried in their place of origin. But the dead people don't vote, even in Bulgaria. So at the moment when this crisis was developing, suddenly a miracle happened. The president got a report that a group of brave Bulgarian anthropologists that had been traveling Central Asia, the places from where the proto-Bulgarians came, found a kind of an ethnic group, which is autonomous republic on the territory of the former Soviet Union, which according to the anthropological data, very much resembled Bulgarians from 2,000 years ago. There was a population of around 500,000 people. And the president was really excited. And he was excited for three very important reasons. First, when these people are going to get Bulgarian passports, Bulgarian population is going to be back to 7.5 million. Secondly, it's true that these people don't know where Bulgaria is. And of course, they don't speak Bulgarian, and probably he does not know what language they do speak. But they have been living in a country in which people used to vote 90% for those who are in power. And because he was incumbent, he didn't see anything wrong getting 500,000 people who are going to vote for him. So the passports were given. Bulgarian population became 7.5 million. But at the end of the book, the things didn't develop in the way the president was expecting, because all the moment these people got their Bulgarian passports, and this is EU passports, instead of coming to Bulgaria, or even instead of basically voting on the elections, they came to Switzerland and basically to Germany or France. I'm telling this story because in a certain way, it's basically the Balkans, but Eastern Europe in general, is one of the places where we're seeing a phenomena that, in my view, is going to affect quite a lot of European democracies in the next decade. And I'm talking about the politics of depopulation. Democracy and demography have been connected for years, and this is not the first time the political scientists are talking about this, but normally the fear was about overpopulation. It was a classical Malthusian kind of a fear that there are going to be too many people and there are not going to be enough food. And also, of course, there was a lot of studies showing that population with quite big number of young people can create a lot of instability, increases the risk of war, the risk of social instability. So it was very much basically this type of an aspect. But in Eastern Europe, what you're seeing, and I do believe this is a European trend, in Eastern Europe is simply, I'm going to say for what kind of a reason, much more visible, we see something different. The demographic transition, which is basically nothing particularly European about this, means that with the improvement of education and with the improvement of standards of living, simply people have a lower birth rates. At the same time, we have a longer life expectancy, so we are living like longer. And in most of the places, you see, if you basically get migration out, a period in which society is shrinking and aging. To the extent that on the last Serbian elections, 53% of the people who voted have been on a retirement age. And then comes the question. To what extent, basically, these stories, one, that you have a small nations with very much kind of defining themselves in ethnic terms, which are shrinking, and aging, and all their 20th century tradition was based very much on the relations between basically ethnicity and the state, how this is going to affect the politics in these countries. And Bulgaria, from this point of view, is a great example because this is the fastest shrinking demographically country in the world today, in the absence of war or natural disasters. And the reason is not simply particularly low birth rates. Bulgarian birth rates are kind of an average European, but you have a kind of a relatively low life expectancies, but what is much more important, you have a lot of out-migration. People are living. They're looking for a better life. They're trying basically to go for different experience. And this is not a Bulgarian phenomenon. You can see it in most of the Central and East European countries, with the exception of Slovenia and the Czech Republic. There are places in which up to one-third of the population has left. Why I'm saying this? If you don't know this fact, you're never going to understand one of the major kind of puzzles about the refugee crisis of 2015 and 2016. And the puzzle is the following. Anti-immigration sentiments were highest in places of Central and Eastern Europe. The problem is that there were no migrants there. In Bulgaria, there are probably 3,000 people that came out of it. So where it comes from? And part of it comes from that it is very much the trauma of the people that have left, not simply the fear of the people that are going to come. That very much explains this. And I have been doing quite a lot of surveys and opinion pollings about this. And you're going to see that this type of a major out-migration creates a series of problems about which we don't know how to talk about. And we don't know how to talk about because when you're asking all East Europeans, what is the best thing that happened to you after 1989? They're going to say opening of the borders. People can study, they can travel, but they have simply a much more interesting life. When you ask people what worries you most, the answer is opening of the borders. So the best and the worst is the same thing. And this is what is at the heart of all this, because you should try to imagine that, for example, in Romania, just for the period 2007-2017, around 15% of the population left, and 70% of them have been younger than 40. It is not the best and the brightest that people said. They're different people. The problem is that this is changing totally the demography. And what is even more important, it's not simply people are living, but all the money invested in their education is living with them. In a certain way, this is a transfer of money from the East to the West that we never talked about. Secondly, if you're a young person living in a country like Bulgaria or Serbia or Croatia, because this type of a demographic problem is everywhere. Croatian census was just published several weeks ago. For the last 10 years, Croatia lost 9% of its population. When this is happening, the very fact that others are living and you are staying kind of forces you to feel as a loser even if your life is okay. Because your friends are not around. In a certain way, there is nobody to share your success with. But also, if you're a young person, in political terms, it's not simply that young people are small cohorts, but when many of them are living, then the young people basically do not have the numbers to influence national politics. So this is the reason why you're going to see a lot of people protesting on the streets, young people. But you're not going to see many of them voting. Because they have the feeling that you can much easier make a kind of an impact on the political life by protesting, being on the streets, basically looking for non-electoral participation. Because unlike the generation of the 1968, the famous baby boomer generation, the young people now do not have the numbers. This type of a politics of depopulation, paradoxically, was very much, in my view, strengthened by the experience of the pandemic. Pandemic, in a way, was a demographic awakening. First, the moment the virus arrived, we all learned exactly how old we are. You know, normally in this type of a lifestyle magazines, they like to say that 60 is the new 40. It was not like this the moment, basically, when the virus arrived, because what the scientists were showing is that the risk of dying by COVID doubles with every 8 years. So suddenly, you know how old you are. By the way, the good joke was that probably 60 is the new 40, but then 10 p.m. is the new 12 p.m. which obviously does not concern you being here. But secondly, what happened very much was that not simply people were in their own age, but we basically got for the first time the experience, those of us which are not old enough, how old people live. When I was talking to my mother during the lockdown, she said, listen, to be honest, not much has changed for me. Normally, I'm meeting not more than 4 or 5 persons. I'm walking 1 or 2 hours and regularly think about death. This type of experience suddenly became the experience of everyone. And we also learn how people older than 80 are living in our societies. Suddenly, the demographic structure of the society was in front of our eyes, but what is even more important, what the COVID pandemic made us to understand is how to think in terms of mathematical models and projections. For human imagination, it's very difficult to think in terms of exponential growth. And psychologists have been explaining it very well. It's very difficult for all of us to imagine that if today 10 people are infected, tomorrow they're not going to be 20, but they're going to be 100. But suddenly this thinking about projections created a situation in which all these projections about the demographic developments of the countries, we start to take them as a reality. Listen, other demographers, right or wrong, we don't know. But suddenly we start to live with these demographic projections as if they are reality. And according to demographic projections, in the year 2040, the population of Bulgaria is going to be slightly more than 5 million. And 68% of the country is going to be what they call demographic desert, which means less than 10 persons populating a square kilometer. Why I'm saying that this type of a fear of depopulation is important to understand certain things that is happening in the democratic regimes far away from Bosnia or Bulgaria or Serbia. Because I do believe that one of the things that we see these days, for example, quite a lot of contested elections, and the example which I'm going to give is the United States, can be very easily explained exactly through two stories that we see in Alek Popov's novel. The first is there was colleagues from the universities of Maryland made the following experiment. They took two groups of white Americans, sociologically the same samples, I mean education, age, where they live in. And to one of the group, they showed the data that claims that in the year 2042, America is going to be majority-minority society. Basically, the white Americans stop to be majority. This data could be contested in many ways, I mean, significantly and seriously, but this is what the data says, and this is what these people learned. The other group didn't know this data. And then you start to ask these two groups their view on migration, their view on kind of other type of a cultural restrictions, redistributive policies, and suddenly you have a major difference between the group who knew the data and the group that didn't know the data. Those who knew the data became much more conservative on everything. The moment when the majorities try to imagine that they're going to be a minority, suddenly their view on the politics and political situation is start to change dramatically. And by the way, this is what we knew from the Balkans in the 1990s. The famous saying in the Balkans was, why me to be a minority in your country when you can be a minority in mine? So this kind of a dynamics create a situation in which when in 2016 President Trump was rallying, he told his supporters, if we're going to lose elections now, then the Democrats are going to give voting rights to all these illegal immigrants. They're going to open the borders and we're never going to win elections in the future. Listen, this is also a very contested statement because if you see the vote of many of the migrants, particularly the Latinos, they're changing their votes and this is not how a political system works. But listen, politicians not always says how the system works, but basically what is going to mobilize support for them. Suddenly the fear was that in the moment of demographic decline and the major movement of population, it is not simply that people are going to elect governments, but governments can elect their own people. Bulgarian president can bring these 2 million to half a million people from Turan. And the major reason they're going to do it, they're going to import voters. So the famous great replacement theory, which is very popular, and this is not the Balkans, look at France, was very much based on the idea that in a moment like this, the biggest fight in a democracy is who is a citizen and who is not, under what kind of conditions. And I'm saying this because, interestingly enough, the clash that we are seeing, and we saw it in the Balkans in the 1990s, is between two different ideas of majority. One is the majority in the way it exists in the nation states, particularly the nation states that have been emerging in Europe after the disintegration of the big empires. And then the majority very much has a color, it has language, it has smell, it's an ethnic majority and it is perceived as permanent. The other is the majority that is born out of on the election night. And it's a totally different majority. And the major story was that these two majorities were very easily coexisting because the assumption was that majority on the election night cannot challenge the permanent majority. But what if you're going to have a major democratic changes? What if we're going to have a different idea of a state? And I'm saying this because in a strange way, one of the major and interesting things to make story about the Balkans, but this is also true about Central and Eastern Europe, is to understand that the state, the history of their state projects very much differ from certain things that we have seen in the West. If you try to imagine the ethnic cultural map of Europe in the year 1900, you're going to see two Europes. One was quite ethnically and culturally homogeneous, and this was Western Europe. Germany, France, Scandinavian. The other was very diverse, and this was the Habsburg and the Ottoman Europe. A lot of minorities, a lot of population, people with a very different religious belief living next to each other. And then over the period of a century, all this has changed. If you're going to see the map of Europe from the year 2000, you're going to see two Europes again, but they're totally different. Now there is one Europe which is much more ethnically homogeneous, and this is Central and Eastern Europe. And the other that is much more ethnically and culturally diverse, and this is Western Europe. And by the way, this is not the guilt of the East Europeans that it happened like this. In the year 1939, around 1/3 of the population of Poland were not ethnic Poles. There were Germans, there were Ukrainians, there were Jews. In 1989, 96% of the population of Poland have been ethnic Poles. The Germans have been expelled, the Jews have been destroyed and murdered, and many of the Ukrainians, there was basically exchange of the population and they went back to the Soviet Union. So as a result of it, in Central and Eastern Europe, ethnic homogeneity has been conceptualized as one of the preconditions for functioning state. And this was done in a pre-communist period. It was done during the communist period too. One of the last things that the Bulgarian government did before the end of the communist regime was renaming and after that expelling 300,000 Turks, because the idea was that the minority group should be kept under a certain percentage. Why I'm saying this? Because then you have the story in which you have the depopulated Balkans, you have depopulated Eastern Europe, but it cannot go like this. And contrary to what people are going to read in the papers, all those countries that have been so strongly against the refugees, suddenly you realize that in the last 3 years before the pandemic, the EU member states that received the highest number of labor migrants was Poland. Of course, mostly Ukrainians, around 2 million, but even 20,000 Pakistanis. As you know, the Polish government was very outspoken that they don't want any Muslims in the country. How Pakistanis are not Muslims, I don't know. But the story is that suddenly you have this situation in which, of course, in many of these countries, you know, that you have a normal economic life, you know, that you have basically any type of a dynamism, you're going to open the borders. But, and here is the last point, which in my view is why what we're seeing in the Balkans is going to be interesting for other parts of Europe and for other parts of the world. The existence of the European Union allows that you can open the borders so people can work, they can have social rights, but nobody is in a hurry to give them the right to vote in the place in which they live. I'm living now most of the time in Vienna. Around between 35 and 40% of the people living in Vienna cannot vote on the Austrian elections. It's not that I don't have a voting rights, I'm voting in Bulgaria. But strangely enough, you're ending up, for example, in a place like Bulgaria, probably in 20 years, with the following structure of the political community. Probably 20% of the people who are going to work on the labor market are not going to have a voting rights. 40, 50% of the people who have a voting rights are going to be on retirement age, so they're not going to be part of the economic life of the country. 10, 15% like me are going to have the right to vote, but we're not paying our taxes in Bulgaria. And my question is how this is changing democracy. What kind of questions can be solved or not solved in this type of communities? How the divorce between the political activity and the economic activity is going to really affect the way our democracies work? And I'm saying this because one of the interesting impacts of globalization is that we are moving. And by the way, this is interesting. People are moving. What we know in the Balkans is that states are also moving. There is a famous story of a man who was born in the year 1900 in one Macedonian village. He lived for 100 years. He never ever left his village, but he succeeded to be the subject of 5 different states. So people were moving, states were moving. But as a result of this kind of a movement, the way democracy and political solidarity, which is so important for any democratic system, is very much transformed. And as a result of it, you start to see an interesting phenomenon even during the COVID period. As you know, there is a very major divide in the vaccination levels between the Eastern Europe and Western Europe. Here, Bulgaria, again, we are very champion. We have only 30% of the public vaccinated. And we have the vaccines. It's not about the vaccines for reasons, by the way, much more complicated in different countries. But in general, the vaccination level in Romania, in Poland, in Hungary, lower than Western Europe. What is much more interesting is that the percent of vaccinated Bulgarians living in Austria is much closer to the percent of the vaccinated Bulgarians in Bulgaria than to the number of the Austrians, with the exception of the people with a university education. So suddenly, you're living a country in a different country, but you're not living your own country because you're living in its information space. In a certain way, all the information about why it is good or bad to be vaccinated, you're getting not from the Austrian government and not from the Austrian media, but from basically through social media, on your own language, and basically this is this type of totally incoherence in a political society, in my view, very much also related to the demographic problems that I'm talking about, is going to change the way we see how democracy works or does not work. And before finishing and making my last point, I just want to tell you that this is not a European problem only. The countries, which of course have these dynamics, and everybody knows about Japan, but the most striking example is South Korea. We are talking about a very fastly developing country, technologically quite fascinating. 2.1 child per woman is the kind of a rate in which society can reproduce itself in the absence of migration. This basically ratio in South Korea is 0.8. With this kind of a trend, in the period of between 25 and 30 years, the South Korean population is going to be halved. It not only this, 40% of the people are living in the single household. So this affects, you know, all this talk about society with a very strong family values and so on. This kind of a dynamic dramatically changes the relations between people, the structure of the family. By the way, this is strongly related with a cult to education in places like South Korea. You don't believe that you can well-educated more than one or maximum two kids, even if you're middle class. Why I'm telling you all this, and here's where I'm going to finish. Because normally we think about politics in terms of left and right, and for very good reasons, and the left and right exist, and they have their differences. But when I see who is on the street, where is the high intensity and passion in democratic politics these days, I see two group of people, kind of a two extinction rebellions. On one level is particularly the younger generation, very much affected by the problem of the climate change. And they see if we're not going to change our way of life, there is not going to be life. On the other side is people who are very much, and this is much more on the right, obsessed with the idea of the demographic extinction. If something is not going to change, they're going to be not us. These two groups of people, these two visions, both of them very strong, by the way, both of them could be very apocalyptical, have a totally different demands to people. For example, for many of the young climate activists, having kids in the world in which there's so many kids for which probably they're not going to be water, they're not going to be food, is irresponsible behavior. If you are basically ethnic nationalist, very much concerned of what is going to happen to your ethnic group, having less than three kids is a betrayal of the nation. This affects many things that on the first reading you're going to be surprised to understand. This fear of not having kids, the idea of that we're declining, that we're decadent, that they're sterile, explains, for example, to admire you a great extent, the total obsession with the far right, with the anti-gay movements. They are not producing kids. Where are our children? And this creates a very strong generational conflict in the way basically all this is perceived. And the clash between these two visions, on one side, the idea of the extinction of the life on the planet, and the other, the end of our way of life, basically the way of the end of our ethnic group, is, in my view, going very much to structure European politics, at least for the coming decade. And just to imagine the scale of all this, imagine that basically some of the studies that have been quite popular these days about the projections of the effect of climate claims that in the year 2070, around 3 billion people are going to be unable to live in the places in which they're living now for climate reasons. So the question, if you're basically thinking in terms of climate, the question is where I'm going to live in 2070. If you're thinking in terms of the demographic extinction, the question is who is going to live on my land in 2070. And I do believe that this kind of a two visions are clashing very much. And there was so much present in the Balkans in the 1990s, but we didn't have the eyes to see this type of contradictions because we are seeing everything that is happening there as coming from the past And suddenly you have a ghost, but this ghost probably is not coming from the past, but from the future. And when these days I have been basically reading also the essay of the Russian president Putin about Russia and Ukraine being the same people, listen, this is the memorandum of the Serbian Academy of Sciences of 1987. It's nevertheless how you're reading at this and that. This is a certain type of sensibility and view of the world. And I do believe that, and this is my last point, the most interesting about the Balkans is not being asking what will happen in the Balkans. The question is, what of the things that is happening in the Balkans today are going to happen in other places? So thank you very much for your...
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram und Facebook. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. Aha, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matjasiewicz. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.